Welcome to the News Roundup on WCAI. I'm Catherine Ident, in for Steve Junker. This is our weekly News Roundup, where we discuss some of the top local news stories of the week with my colleagues in print and digital media. Joining me this morning will be Kristen Young from the Cape Cod Times. We'll also hear from George Brennan from the Martha's Vineyard Times, Holly Pretzky of the Vineyard Gazette, Casey Myers from the Provincetown Banner, and we'll check in with Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle. We'll also hear from WCAI reporter Sarah Mises-Tan, Morning Edition producer Sam Houghton, and WCAI science correspondent Heather Goldstone. Joining me first this morning is our reporter Sarah Mises-Tan. Good morning, Sarah.
Good morning, Catherine.
So, Sarah, you covered a meeting this week up in Plymouth, once again talking about the Pilgrim Nuclear Power Plant. There were some frustrated elected officials and residents, and they were talking to members of the Federal Nuclear Regulatory Commission. The two sides don't exactly have the same agenda. So tell me how that meeting went.
Sure. Yeah. So the Federal Nuclear Regulatory Commission was in town to basically compile a report for best practices for citizens advisory panels as more plants start to come offline. They say they kind of want to take what was good. They wanted to take feedback from the community. What worked for them? What didn't work for them about having a citizens advisory panel so that they could take that back, put it into a report, and then maybe make some sort of standardized rules and regulations around citizens advisory boards around the country.
And they got an earful.
Yeah, they certainly got an earful. Of course, a lot of people took this opportunity to essentially voice frustration over the Holtec transfer. I think there was a lot of frustration and a lot of anger just around how a lot of them felt like they put a lot of time and effort into participating in the Citizens Advisory Board, which did put a lot of concerns up to the NRC, and a lot of them felt largely ignored.
Mm. And so tell me more about what people were saying there. I mean, you heard some passionate arguments saying that they were ignored and this is a safety issue. It's not just a power struggle. This is far bigger in their minds.
Definitely. I think a lot of people are the Citizens Advisory Board and the state's attorney general's office has voiced concerns just about if Holtec is able to be financially stable and safely decommission the plant with the money that's in the decommissioning fund. A lot of people are worried that Massachusetts may be on the line to pick up the tab if Holtec runs out of money while decommissioning. And I think there's a lot of concern just over whether or not Holtec can safely decommission that plant in that very short time span that they mentioned. And of course, Holtec hasn't yet agreed with the town of Plymouth about what their plans are for this land.
Mm-hmm.
The town of Plymouth wants to hear that they're going to rehabilitate that land and give it back to them. And Holtec has not yet sat down at the table and agreed to any terms.
Instead, all we know is that Holtec says they can do it in a fraction of the time that the former plant owner, Entergy, said, which was like 60 years. Holtec's saying something like 8 years.
Yeah, it's a dramatically shorter timeline. And the Citizens Advisory Board, a lot of watchdog groups have asked, how are you able to have such an accelerated timeline? And they haven't really given any answers, aside from saying that they're experts in decommissioning, and so they can just do it that much faster.
And so do these citizens groups, and we should say, too, elected officials like City Attorney General Mara Healey and a representative from U.S. Senator Ed Markey's office and former elected officials also were with the watchdog groups on this. Is there any recourse for them?
Yeah, Neil Sheehan, the press person from the NRC, does say that there have been requests for hearings submitted to the NRC to review Holtec's transfer. They say that there's still time for the commission's board to say, yes, we want to have a hearing. And so we could retroactively have that hearing. But at this point, I think a lot of people are kind of viewing this as a case closed. The keys have been handed over to Holtec. And we're just going to look forward into decommissioning and what that's going to look like.
And you will be on that story.
Yes.
You will be giving us all those updates. That's WCA. AI reporter Sarah Mises-Tan. Sarah, thanks for coming in.
Thanks so much.
And on the line from the Cape Cod Times now is reporter Kristen Young to talk about some other top stories of the week. Good morning, Kristen.
Good morning, Catherine.
Kristen, we learned this week that a Falmouth police officer who was wounded when a suspect shot him last year along with his partner was also involved in a separate case involving excessive force, and a jury cleared him of the charges. Tell us a little bit more about that case and that decision.
Yes, so this was a three-day jury trial in June, and it was a federal jury, and what they did is they cleared Falmouth Police Officer Ryan Moore of a civil charge of using excessive force during a traffic stop that occurred in 2014. Moore had pulled over Carly Taylor, who was then 28, after he saw her swerve her car around two bicyclists on Route 28 late on the evening of September 9th, 2014. And the bar that Taylor left had actually already called the police department with Taylor's license plate number, saying that she had appeared intoxicated when she left. Moore, when he stopped Taylor, instructed her to get out of the car for a field sobriety test several times, but Taylor said she wanted to wait for a police backup unit. Moore did call for that backup unit, but apparently he did not wait for its arrival. Court documents show that Moore opened the car door, pulled Taylor out and behind the vehicle, then pushed her onto her stomach and onto the ground and placed his knee on her back in a move that's called a full body mount. Moore then told her to put her hands behind her back to be handcuffed, and when she failed to do so, he reportedly tasered her. In U.S. District Court documents, Taylor said she was unable to get her hands from behind her back, though, because she was pinned to the ground. Taylor was arraigned in Falmouth District Court on drunken driving charges. The court ultimately continued those charges for a year without finding, but after the arraignment, she was taken to Falmouth Hospital, where she was diagnosed with facial trauma and a concussion and a headache. The headaches continued, and a medical expert for her suit against Moore diagnosed her in December with post-concussion syndrome, with migraines and with cough and sneeze-induced headaches. Experts for Moore, though, testified that he was just in removing and immobilizing Taylor since he had warned her several times first. And there was testimony from experts on both sides, and the jury then concluded that Taylor had not proven that Moore used excessive force. And Falmouth Police Chief Edward Dunn said that he was really pleased with the verdict. He said they knew all along that Moore had not done anything wrong and that he'd gone through all the department's training. As you mentioned, Moore is currently on disability leave. He and fellow police officer Donald DeMiranda were both shot in July of 2018 by 21-year-old Malik Koval, and that happened when they responded to a neighborhood disturbance near Seacoast Shores Boulevard. Moore was treated for a bullet that grazed his neck and then was released from the hospital. DeMiranda, who was shot in the shoulder and chest, required surgery, and he remained hospitalized for several days. Both officers have been on leave since the shooting. They were recognized by the department as Officers of the Year earlier this year and also received the Medal of Honor.
Right, and the town's working with state lawmakers on a bill to allow both of those officers to go out on disability retirement and receive 100% of their pay rather than what's more standard, which is about 80% of their pay as well.
Yes, that's correct.
Let's take a look at another story. It's kind of a preview story of what's coming up this weekend, and that is the Mashpee Wampanoag Tribe is going to be holding a recall election for the first time. And up for recall will be Tribe Chairman Cedric Cromwell and Tribe Treasurer Gordon Harris. They face being removed from office.
Yes, so this will happen on Sunday, and it's Mashpee Wampanoag Tribal Chairman Cedric Cromwell and Gordon Harris, who's the treasurer, and they're facing multiple allegations from a group of tribe members who are accusing the two of malfeasance in connection with a bunch of issues, and some of them stem from the more than $500 million that's owed to the tribe's financial backer, Genting Malaysia, and from decisions to keep Tribal Council Vice Chairwoman Jessie Little Doe Baird in power after she resigned on January 25th. The hearing will be the tribe's first recall election, and this is a process that's written into the tribe's constitution. And what happens is it's triggered by the submission of petitions to remove the officials in question, and those petitions require the signature of 100 or more tribe members. The election would come roughly a week after the Times learned that Harris and his predecessor, Robert Hendricks, were actually subpoenaed by a federal grand jury, although it's still unclear for what reason. The petitioners also intend to argue that Cromwell has promoted his personal business interests while he was traveling and acting in his capacity as chairman. Cromwell did respond to these allegations in a letter addressed to the tribe's election committee on May 15th, denying that charge, and he also noted that the tribal election voted not to accept Baird's resignation letter. He also said that, take a look at the economic growth that's taken place under his leadership as a result of Genting's commitment to loaning the tribe money and to support its programs and services. But Genting has since withdrawn its support after writing off more than $44 million it loaned to the tribe as a loss in late 2018, and that forced rounds of layoffs at the Mashpee Wampanoag headquarters. Petitioners are alleging that Cromwell deprived the tribe of up to $500,000 in tribal employment rights known as ordinance fees. This is called TARO, and these ordinances require employers conducting businesses conducting business on the reservation to give tribes preferences in all manner of employment, contracting, and relating activities. And Aaron Toby Jr., who's a tribal council member and a petitioner in the recall effort, said that Cromwell allegedly failed to negotiate and collect those funds in relationship to the tribe's affordable housing development project off Meeting House Road. He said that Cromwell didn't impose any fees, and that actually resulted in costing the tribe hundreds of thousands of dollars.
Mm. And I think, too, what's been interesting in kind of watching this, the details develop, too, is some are saying that the newspaper has been the only place to really find details about what's been going on financially behind the scenes. And there's a real desire among tribe members, many tribe members, for transparency.
Yes, that's true. There are tribe members who are saying, you know, they do have another publication, but they were calling it sort of a feel-good publication that reports on matters in the tribe, and that they want to know more about, you know, transparency and what's going on with the tribe's finances. Since his rise to power in 2009, Cromwell's repeatedly come under fire for the handling of the finances, with most people saying, you know, that there isn't a lot of transparency happening here. Groups have attempted to rally tribe members to force open the administration's books, including its casino records, and to protest the periodic shunning and silencing of members who've raised questions about tribal finances. Sources said recently that the tribe is operating without a membership-approved budget, and that statements of expenses provided to the tribal government show that they're just a real paucity of funds right now available for programs and other services. And there was an affidavit detailing the petitioner's accusations, and that says that Cromwell has been paid more than $1 million since he took office, but that 10 years later, the tribe has incurred more than $500 million in debt with very little to show for it, no casino, no jobs, and a mortgaged property in Taunton where the tribe's billion-dollar casino resort would be located. In January, Cromwell was actually temporarily stripped of his fiduciary powers after news surfaced of the $37,000 that he and his wife, Cheryl Fry Cromwell, owe the IRS and business interests that were subpoenaed during the course of their divorce proceeding. The council has since reversed itself, voting to restore Cromwell's fiduciary responsibilities and to rescind a vote of no confidence in his leadership.
And so we'll see what happens. There's a lot there for people in the tribe to think about as they head into this election on Sunday. I want to look at a story out of Dennis Yarmouth. The math teacher from the Dennis Yarmouth Regional High School is suing the district. He wants to be reinstated after he was suspended on allegations that he harassed female students.
Yes, so a lawyer for Christopher Korna, who is the math teacher you mentioned, filed the lawsuit and an emergency motion for Korna's reinstatement September 5th in Barnstable Superior Court. The suit names the school district, Superintendent Carol Woodbury, and DY High School Principal Paul Funk as defendants. And according to court documents, Korna has taught 11th and 12th grade math at DY High School for 15 years. He was suspended on May 29th, though, pending the results of an investigation into whether he violated Title IX, which is a federal law that protects against discrimination on the basis of sex in federally funded education programs. The lawsuit contends that Korna's lawyers were notified on August 28th that the investigation found that Korna had not violated Title IX, and that a day later, Funk, who's the principal of DY, provided Korna with his class roster for the upcoming school year. Korna reported to work from August 29th to 31st, and that was before students were there, mainly for like staff meetings and preparing his classrooms, things like that. And he was seen in the building during that time by Funk, who initially appeared to have no issues with Korna's return. But on August 31st, Funk emailed Korna to say that Korna was still suspended, and that other than saying that he had been mistaken in bringing Korna back to work, Funk provided no basis for the continued suspension. The lawsuit goes on to say that the suspension was clearly the act of the school superintendent without just cause. Korna's complaint asks the court to order school administrators to immediately reinstate him and inform him of the reason for this continued suspension. The suit also requests that the school cover Korna's attorney's fees and pay him $75,000 in damages for the emotional trauma he endured as a result of the district's actions.
Talk a little bit about what the allegations were that led to this suspension. It sounds like a couple students accused him of making some derogatory remarks, and other student witnesses seem to corroborate that story.
Yes, so there was a report into the investigation that came out on August 28th, and that report states that Torn had made at least two comments to one student, telling her you need a spanking when the two had disagreed about an assignment, and another time telling her you have a fuzzy on your tush. Korna did not deny making those comments, but he did deny another instance in which he allegedly asked the same student, you on your period or something. The report says that student witnesses also allege that Korna might have created a discriminatory environment in his class for female students in general. A male student told investigators he had heard Korna make similar comments to other female students about their periods. He also said Korna had spoken with him directly about two female students, saying that the girls would be, quote, pregnant by next year and that they would drop out of college. Korna adamantly denied making both those statements when he was asked by investigators. Two male students told investigators that Korna would frequently stare at many female students inappropriately in class and in the hallways, and named three students which he would apparently stare at frequently. A third male student said that once he had been staring inappropriately at a female student, and that Korna saw him staring and smiled and nodded when he noticed the student was staring. The victim herself told investigators that Korna would stare at her inappropriately, and she said it was really uncomfortable when he wouldn't look her in the eye. Korna denied looking at any students inappropriately, according to the report. And several other students who, you know, were in class or in the hallways denied ever seeing him do that or thinking that he had ever done that.
And the report did find that there wasn't enough evidence to violate Title IX, but it did recommend disciplinary action. I'm talking with Kristen Young of the Cape Cod Times. You're listening to the News Roundup. Kristen, I want to look at a story in Hyannis. Some business owners on Main Street say they feel like they're being a little bit treated unfairly because some outdoor events on the Village Green have private food and liquor vendors, and they say that that's taking business away from the shops and restaurants on Main Street.
Yes, so this is a group of about more than 15 downtown restaurant owners or their representatives, and they've signed on to a petition to ban food, beer, and wine vendors from operating on the Village Green or on Main Street during events. They claim the practice promotes unfair competition with brick-and-mortar businesses in the area. Now, since the summer of 2018, the town has allowed beer and wine at special events at three downtown locations, which are the Hyannis Village Green, the Hyannis Harbor Overlook, and Azleton Park. Barnstable Town Manager Mark Ells said that he hasn't received any complaints directly to his office, and that there was a year-long process and evaluation of the town's special event programs at the request of businesses, and that that's what led to the decision to allow beer and wine. Elle said that this is really all because the community asked for more events and to bring more people to Main Street, and that the town's intention certainly was not to do anything that would conflict with local businesses. Tina Carey, who's the owner of Tequila Charlie's on Main Street, is spearheading the signature drive. And Carey said that their businesses are all for having events on the Village Green and on Main Street, but not for allowing the service of food and liquor at those events. She cited events such as movie nights and concert as benefiting businesses because they don't compete. Elle said that he's listening to concerns that are being brought forth in the petition, and that he himself has walked regularly along Main Street to speak with business owners. He said there have only been six times this calendar year where alcohol has been served at the Village Green, but Carey said that's six times that Main Street businesses are losing business. She said that when there's food and liquor available at these events, people tend to stay along the green or in those areas rather than walk along Main Street to patronize local businesses. But Elizabeth Werfbein, who's the executive director of the Business Improvement District, disagrees with Carey. Werfbein said that studies show that it is best practice to hold events that would bring people to downtown areas. She said that a recent craft festival on the Village Green, her organization conducted a survey of 100 attendees and found that virtually all of them had come to the downtown area for the festival and planned on walking along Main Street afterwards. Werfbein said another survey conducted at the Quahog Festival, where beer and wine from Main Street businesses were sold, yielded similar results. And she also questioned the validity of these signatures on the petition. And what she said was that some of them were not from the owners of the restaurants themselves. She said some proprietors she spoke with had never even heard of the petition. Carey denied that, though. She said that she had asked some managers who do hold a lot of authority if they had authority to sign the petition, and that's why their names are on there instead of the owners.
So it sounds like more discussion to be had and more data collecting to be had before any kind of changes or new decisions are made regarding this.
Yes, that's correct.
And that's Kristen Young, a reporter with the Cape Cod Times. Kristen, thanks so much for joining us this morning.
Thank you, Catherine.
Some big news on the South Coast in Fall River this week. The city council voted to temporarily remove Mayor Jaisal Correa from office after he now faces a second round of federal charges. He's accused of extorting hundreds of thousands of dollars from marijuana vendors who wanted to open up shop in the city. I talked with WCAI Morning Edition producer Sam Houghton for a recap of what's been going on this week. Good morning, Sam.
Morning.
Sam, remind us what charges Correa, or at least what these new charges are that Correa is facing.
Yeah, so he's really facing 24 charges, the big ones being conspiracy, extortion, and bribery. And this is just months after Correa was actually indicted for essentially stealing from investors his startup company called Snow Owl. He was arrested last week with these new charges while he was playing tennis in Fall River. The indictment against him is charging that he extorted almost $600,000. And these are mostly related to marijuana companies looking to move into Fall River.
How did he go about actually extorting these companies?
Yeah, so as the mayor, he is essentially the authority for allowing these companies to open. He approves what are called host agreements between the city and the company. And federal investigators are charging that Correa lied to the companies by saying that he would only approve a handful of licenses. And that really inflated the value of each license. And then as the mayor, he asked for bribes in return for granting these host agreements. And it wasn't just money either. He's also charged with extorting something like 15 pounds of marijuana from companies. And one bribe included a Rolex watch. That actually wasn't related to marijuana business, but regarding a municipal water supply. So kind of interesting there. He could serve up to 20 years in prison if convicted of these allegations.
And so City Council earlier this week voted 8-1 to remove Correa from office. Talk about that vote and what that means.
Right. So the City Council took a vote on Tuesday evening, essentially forcing Correa to step down. City Council President Cliff Ponte came up with this motion. He's actually filling the role of mayor for now. And really, they're just fed up with Correa's behavior. One councilor compared him to infamous Providence Mayor Buddy Cianci. So the council argued that he's just unfit to be the mayor, considering he's in federal indictment. And the vote was 8-1 in favor of the motion.
And Correa has responded. He had a press conference. What's he saying?
Yeah, he's not backing down. He addressed a room of reporters at a press conference Wednesday saying he would not step down. He said it's up to voters to determine his fate, not just eight city councilors that voted. He said he looks forward to a general election, which is scheduled for November 5th. Also kind of interesting, he has been coming to work, but he will have to get through a primary just to make it to that general election in November.
And that's WCAI Morning Edition producer Sam Houghton. Sam, thanks for this recap.
Thanks, Katie.
And I want to take a look at some news from the islands. So let's start first out of Martha's Vineyard with Holly Presky of the Vineyard Gazette. She joins us now on the phone. Good morning, Holly.
Good morning, Catherine.
Well, a story I want to talk about with you that we've all been following for a few weeks, and that is of the Tisbury School. They started a week late on Monday after officials discovered high enough amounts of lead paint in part of the school building that they decided they needed to delay school and move students around. So how did that first day of school go?
Well, all things considered, it went pretty smoothly. So half of the students, students in grades 5-8, started school at the regional high school. They took over some classrooms in a wing of the high school. And then the younger students, students in grades kindergarten through 4, started school in kind of a sequestered area of the Tisbury School that was built in the 1990s. So there's no lead paint in that area. And there are a lot of challenges. You know, there's transportation logistics of getting half the kids to one place and half the kids to another. And a lot of the students are sharing, a lot of the classes are sharing one classroom when they typically would be in two. And there's one room in the high school that's being shared by 3 special education teachers and 2 English language learning teachers. So it's a little cramped in there. But all things considered, it seems like morale is good. I spoke with students this week on the first day of school, and they were excited to be back together with their friends. You know, some of them said the adults need to calm down, stop worrying about us so much. And the main concern that I heard from students who were going to the high school is that they were really nervous about being in close proximity with high school
with
students.
The big
kids. They were intimidated.
Yeah.
Right, exactly. But the high school students, according to the principal, Sarah Dingledye, the high school principal, have been really cooperative as well and supportive and have steered clear of that area where the middle schoolers are.
That's good. So it sounds like a smooth start, smooth week. Officials, of course, are working behind the scenes to get this lead taken out of the school, and they hired a project manager. Is that right?
Yes. And I should say just really quick that the Martha's Vineyard Hospital is offering free lead testing for Tisbury School students. And as of this week, they had conducted 30 tests, and they'd all come back negative. So just to get that out there, that no students have actually had elevated levels of lead, or we haven't discovered any elevated levels of lead.
That's good. Allay some concerns there. Yeah.
Yeah. But they hired an owner's project manager, selectman, and the school committee unanimously voted this week. So that's a big step for them to have some professional advice on whether to set up a modular school or to do lead abatement. And also, there's plans in the works. They want to completely overhaul the school and either do a major renovation or build a new school. As you probably remember, a major school building project failed at the ballot box last year.
Right.
So they're kind of starting from scratch on that as well.
Renewed interest in that. And, of course, we'll be following along with that, as I'm sure you will, at the Vineyard Gazette. That's Holly Preske. Thanks so much for checking in. Have a great weekend.
You too. Thank you.
I want to turn now to Tim Wood, who's joining us on the phone of the Cape Cod Chronicle. Good morning, Tim.
Good morning.
Tim, a nursing home in Chatham that closed rather abruptly in the spring. It sounds like it's going to be converted into apartments.
Exactly. It's actually in Harwich, the Royal of Harwich.
Oh, I'm sorry. That's my fault there.
That's fine. It's in Harwich Center. Excuse me. The assisted living facility at the corner of Bank and Parallel Street, it abruptly closed after about 15 years in business back in May. The owner had notified residents in the state of plans to close in July and then hiked monthly fees and then had to rescind that. So it was kind of an odd situation. But last week, Matthew Newman of Royal Apartments LLC purchased the property for $1.5 million, and he also bought the lot next door for another $500,000. Now, Newman is a part-time resident of Harwich, and he said his goal is to convert the facility into year-round market-rate apartments for working people like teachers and firefighters. And he told us he's currently working with an architect and engineer to determine exactly what can be done on the property, but he sort of indicated that what they're looking at is maybe approximately 25 one-bedroom units there.
It's pretty centrally located. I was just going to kind of add on to what you're saying or have you explain that. It's fairly centrally located. So is it a good spot, you think, for apartments for folks to live in?
Yeah, it's right in the middle of Harwich Center, which is the sort of typical village center that the town has been trying to reinvigorate over the past few years. There's a few new developments being eyed there, a convenience store is being built where an old gas station used to be there. And, you know, it's right near the Brooks Library and Town Hall, and the community center's right down the road. And Harwich Port is just down Bank Street. So it is actually very centrally located. It would be a good location for the sort of multifamily housing that the town is trying to encourage. And it's actually zoned for multifamily housing. So that is allowed where the property is. And it's also in the historic district for the Harwich Center. And the main part of the building, or at least one part of the building, dates from around 1825. So they'll have to go before Historical Commission for some review on that.
Right. So some permitting, but also fewer hurdles if they're already being in an area that's zoned for housing, because there's certainly an appetite for it around here.
Correct. And it was a senior living facility, so it was technically multifamily housing before it closed recently.
That's right. That is Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle. Tim, thanks so much for checking in. We appreciate it.
Thank you. Take care.
I have George Brennan now on the phone, a news editor at the Martha's Vineyard Times. Good morning, George.
Good morning, Katie.
George, there's been a fight over the early morning freight runs out of Woods Hole for a while now, and the Steamship Authority heard from both sides of the argument again this week.
Yeah, this was at a public hearing at Falmouth High School this week, and it was actually called as a result of a petition drive from Woods Hole residents objecting to the 2020 schedule of the Steamship Authority, which calls for a continuation of these 5:30 a.m. ferry runs both to and from the vineyard. They're mostly freight runs at that point in the day. Woods Hole residents say that the trucks that rumble by on Woods Hole Road wake them from their slumber. But folks on the vineyard say these are essential in order to keep the goods and services coming to and from the island. One of the main things, and these particular trucks don't go on this 5:30 a.m. ferry, but by clearing out some of the early freight, fuel trucks, for example, go at 6:30, and they come to the island at a time when there isn't a lot of traffic on the road. Anybody who's been to the vineyard knows very narrow streets, and there's a lot of traffic in the summertime, so the fuel trucks like to get in and out of here early in the morning. So that's one of the main things, one of the main reasons they want these early morning runs to continue. But there was debate on both sides, and it's going to be difficult for the Steamship Authority to find some middle ground here.
There's not a lot of options, really.
Right. The Woods Hole residents are just adamantly opposed to this, and vineyard residents are saying, it's needed. And the numbers bear it out. The number of freight runs has increased 4% each year and doubled from the beginning of this century. So there are more and more people coming to the island and, the need for services. The one thing that kept getting brought up over and over again, of course, is New Bedford.
Yeah, that automatically comes to mind now when you hear about this ongoing, argument.
Right. It's not an easy solution, though, because New Bedford doesn't really have a port available at this point to a freight ferry. So that's infrastructure that would have to be built. And you're talking about millions and millions of dollars. As Woods Hole folks should know, with the terminal project that's going on in Woods Hole, it's about a $60 million project right in their own backyard. So it isn't cheap to build these ports where ferries can go in and out of. So there's a lot to be dealt with, short-term solutions versus long-term solutions. And I'm not sure that the Steamship Authority got all the answers that they might need to make a decision, but we're going to find out next month.
Yeah, they're going to have to make a decision sooner rather than later on that one. And just briefly, George, we'll leave a minute or so. A golfer hit a hole-in-one and shot his age this week. Pretty cool, worth a mention. So tell us about that.
That is pretty cool. It was Jim Smith. He's 78, so he shot his age. And he also managed during his round at Farm Neck to get a hole-in-one, which is pretty cool as
well.
Not
easy, yeah.
Yeah, not the first of his career, but amazingly, he shot his age, six times in the past 6 years. I'm sorry,
11
times. 11 times in the past 6 years, and that's pretty significant because, of his age, you don't generally get better at golf at that point. So amazingly, he was able to do that. And I could tell you, as sort of a duffer myself, I've shot my age. Unfortunately, it was for 9 holes.
Oh, well,
No hole-in-ones either.
No hole-in-ones. We can keep practicing. He looks like, I was looking at that article, and he sounds like he's an avid golfer, but congratulations to him. George Brennan from the Martha's Vineyard Times, thanks so much for checking in. Have a great weekend.
Yeah, you too. Thanks.
I'm going to turn now to news from the Outer Cape, from the Provincetown Banner, and Casey Myers, who joins us on the phone. Good morning, Casey.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm well. Thanks for joining us. Story in Truro. Truro, just one of two towns in Massachusetts that allows marijuana farms in residential neighborhoods. And town officials have come up with a way to deal with potential complaints from neighbors.
Yes, the town of Truro entered into a community host agreement with the High Dune Craft Cooperative a couple weeks ago. And lots of aspects of this community host agreement are similar to the ones that you see in all the towns with other types of marijuana businesses. They usually host community agreements, spell out the amount of mitigation fees that the businesses are going to pay to the towns in lieu of any problems that could arise with police or other issues that we don't really know about because it's a totally new business. But what's different in Truro and with these farmers, there's actually five of them and only four are in Truro, is that they're going to be growing their product in the outdoors, in neighborhoods, and neighbors are going to have to deal with the smell, possibly.
Yeah.
And as you say, one of two communities in the state that are allowing growing in residential areas, the other one's in western Massachusetts. And so what the town did was put something in place so that there can be a mediation process for neighbors who are bothered by the smell. The mediation process doesn't supersede other kinds of nuisance violations, which neighbors also make and go through a more zoning and planning legal process. But they could also try this mediation, and it would be triggered when six people complain about a farm, and they must live within 600 feet of the farm.
So pretty close.
Yeah, right. And so this would get away from the fear that the farmers have that people would philosophically complain about marijuana being grown legally rather than actually really being bothered by the smell.
Right. I find it interesting that they have this process in place, given the fact that if it's grown outside, it is a plant that has a strong fragrance. And so, you know, what can they do? We have gusty winds here on the Cape.
It's true. What can they do? I wonder that myself. The good news, I guess, for the neighbors is that marijuana plants only produce an odor 6 weeks out of the year maximum, and that's when they're flowering. And on Cape Cod, the crops would be flowering in the early to late fall. And the flowers produce terpenes, which is an aromatic oil secreted from the plant. It can't get you high, but it could certainly waft on the breeze to, depending on a bunch of different factors, including a clear, crisp, windy day like today, where it would definitely travel very far, or a hot, humid day, it wouldn't travel as far because the air is so heavy. And it also apparently depends on the type of plant you're growing. Some are more odoriferous than others.
Right. Well, an interesting process they are developing and trying to push forward the marijuana industry in Truro. Casey Myers of the Provincetown Banner, thanks so much for this update.
Okay, thank you. Have a good day.
Beacon Hill had more of a normal week this week after returning from summer recess. House and Senate leaders promise they'll get a lot done this fall session. I talked with WCAI State House reporter Mike Dean to find out if he thinks they'll muster the votes to knock some of those big items off the agenda. Good morning, Mike.
Hey, good morning, Catherine.
So it was a busy week at the State House with folks getting back into their routines.
Yeah, it definitely was. There were 9 or 10 hearings in all sorts of different legislative committees and Veterans Affairs Committee, Financial Services, Public Health, Judiciary, really even more, had a number of really long agendas. So I think that the bill hearing portion of lawmaking has definitely resumed here at the State House. And perhaps more importantly, this was the first Big Three meeting that we've had in a while. That's, of course, when Governor Baker, Senate President Karen Spilka, and Speaker Robert DeLeo all kind of sit down and have a confab on Monday afternoons.
Right, and we don't always talk about this meeting because it is a fairly regular meeting, but because it's the first in a while, I want to talk about it with you. What did Governor Baker want to address?
Yeah, he has a list of priorities that he wants to get through. I would imagine, though, when he sat down, he kind of wanted to go over some of the unfinished business from before this August recess. Mainly his interest is that driving bill that the House and Senate have still not compromised on. This is, of course, the hands-free safe driving bill, which would require a hands-free mode for any kind of handheld device. Essentially means you can't hold your cell phone while you're operating a vehicle. Right now we have a no texting while driving rule, but it doesn't really get enforced. Massachusetts is the only state in New England that doesn't have a similar law on the books. New York has had one for some time. And basically, it has come down to this gridlock between the House and the Senate in their negotiations that we haven't seen this done. It was a priority of Baker earlier in the session. He probably wants to know what is up with that. And it could be shades of the end of last session, last July, when the House and Senate negotiations broke down on a number of things. And, you know, Democratic leaders from both branches just couldn't see eye to eye on a lot of big issues. So I think he would be worried that potentially other things might be left in limbo if lawmakers don't get their act together.
Right. He also gave lawmakers something of an ultimatum last week, and that's with housing. He wants a bill on his desk.
Yeah, this is something he is definitely putting a lot of urgency into. Essentially, this bill that Baker has would lower the threshold from 2/3 to 1/2, the amount of approval that's needed to change local zoning laws, which would then enable more construction of housing and homes in any town or city. So this is something where a lot of votes have kind of had more than 50% support, but they haven't reached that 2/3. And so a lot of projects and developments haven't been able to go through. Baker wants this change of the law so that towns can then get going, passing these things at town meeting or via select boards, and then start building more come next spring. He says that they have to get this done by Thanksgiving. This is the legislature. The legislature has to get it done by Thanksgiving, or else we're going to miss the spring's town meeting season, where a lot of these decisions will be made, and to get, you know, shovels in the ground and housing built over the course of next year.
And kind of following on that whole Thanksgiving deadline, what is going on with the plan to rewrite the K-12 education funding formula?
Well, all indication from the legislative side says that a bill could come out of the Education Committee really in the next few weeks, so that members can then have time to tweak it in both chambers before kind of passing it at the end of the fall or closer to that Thanksgiving date. There's talk that education chairs Representative Alice Peisch on the House side and Senator Jason Lewis, they're working pretty collaboratively on this committee draft, and that means that we might not see what is becoming the typical chamber-on-chamber acrimony this time around. This bill could come out a little bit more agreed upon than other bills do when both chambers have their own versions. This could be something that the middle ground might already be staked out. Because you got to remember, a similar bill, or at least a bill to do something similar, failed to pass at the end of last session, last July, over a year ago. And so now a lot of school districts are very frustrated that, you know, Beacon Hill has not gotten another bill in place towards the governor's desk. One interesting thing that happened this week is that Governor Baker said that he would be happy waiting on an education bill until the end of the session. So he's not applying that Thanksgiving deadline to an education bill, where then you speak to House Speaker Robert DeLeo, like I asked him this week, and he said he still intends to get it done in the fall. So this is the rare example where the legislative schedule is actually ahead of what the governor might want or demand from those lawmakers.
Also on the table and was up for discussion this week is a bill that would remove gender from nearly all state forms and documents.
Yeah, that's something that the State Administration Committee heard today. Now, we have dealt before with the kind of gender X issue, which would be essentially allowing a third designation on a driver's license. So you can get, capital M, capital F, capital X. It's really as simple as that for non-binary folks who don't want to go with the M or the F. This would be a little bit deeper. This would essentially study all state documents, all different forms that request gender information, things like that, and try to remove gender in as much as possible if it's not necessary for the form, or to allow, you know, a third option, or just leave it off entirely for if it's not even necessary to do. So this is a deeper dive into that same issue, and I should remind you that that issue, the Gender X driver's license bill, has also failed last year at the end of the session. Now, the Senate has passed it again this year. But this is, these new efforts are a little bit broader, and we could see this come up towards the end of the session. But it's not too much of a priority for a lot of leaders up here, especially because Karen Spilka, the Senate president, is really behind that driver's license one. So I think that piece will get finished first.
Our state lawmakers can look to lawmakers in other states. There's quite a few that already have similar statutes in place.
Yeah, I think a lot of states are finding that the gender is not that necessary a thing to point out on these types of forms and documents. One thing that we heard in testimony during that hearing this week was that limiting it to male or female leads to transgender or non-binary residents lying on the form. They're essentially answering the form inaccurately in a way that they don't feel reflects themselves. You know, it may reflect their past, which is another issue that, you know, people aren't comfortable with. And a lot of folks testified to getting into kind of dangerous situations or uncomfortable situations, at least, because what it says on their ID does not match how they feel personally or how they appear in public. And you can imagine, you know, carrying a card around that does not reflect how you are. And so the argument is here, this will allow for accurate reporting and accurate forms. There was supposed to be a lot of opposition to this. The Republican Party in the state had said that they were going to stand against this, but at the hearing, there was no one speaking in opposition.
Also, in, I'm going to use air quotations, big news, Governor Charlie Baker rode the T this week. Why is this news, you might ask? Well, it was the first time that Charlie Baker rode the red line since he became governor. And I found it funny that the Boston Globe had the headline about finding Charlie on the MBTA. What was this all about?
Well, I found it funny that the Boston Globe was the only media organization that knew ahead of time that he was going to ride the MBTA. So I think that might explain why they made such a big deal out of it. So it's a big deal because Baker has never ridden on the MBTA since his time in office. He has, you know, prior to becoming governor. But he's always said that, you know, it would be kind of a circus atmosphere if he ever took it. And, you know, a lot of folks have been criticizing him for not taking it, for seeming out of touch because he isn't in tune with what a normal commuter every day is going to go through, you know, on the red line. This is something that Baker's been, you know, trying to avoid, but he had an event at Wollaston Station. They were reopening it. That's in Quincy. He was coming from Beacon Hill, so he hopped on the red line at Park Street, went down a few stops, went by JFK UMass, the site of that massive derailment earlier in the summer, and I asked him about it later on in the day. He said it was absolutely fine. So no protesters, no big deal for nonchalant Charlie on the MTA.
Are we going to see Charlie on the MBTA anytime soon again?
I don't know. I think maybe of course, we're getting new orange and red line vehicles. I think that if the governor does take it, it's always going to kind of be more of a staged thing. I don't think he's going to be taking the train to and from events throughout his normal day.
And that is WCAI State House reporter Mike Dean talking with us from Beacon Hill. Mike, thanks so much for joining us.
Great to be with you.
And joining me in studio right now is Dr. Heather Goldstone. She hosts Living Lab Radio here at WCAI and WGBH. Heather, you're here to talk about a new study, and it's about methane leaks in Northeast cities.
Yeah, so this has been an increasingly, high-profile issue in recent years, right, as our reliance on natural gas has increased. There's been more and more concern about how much methane, which is the primary ingredient in natural gas, actually leaks out of both the extraction process, but then the pipelines and the infrastructure involved in transporting and using natural gas. And this was a new survey where they specifically looked at six cities from DC up to Boston along the Northeast Corridor, flying over with airplanes and measuring methane, but also carbon dioxide, carbon monoxide, a couple of other different gases that are greenhouse gases, but together can kind of give a hint of where that methane might be coming from. And what they found, upshot, is that the amount of methane coming from natural gas infrastructure in these Northeast cities is probably about twice what the EPA tends to budget. So it's a lot higher than the government is budgeting and accounting for in our emissions scenarios and also in thinking about natural gas infrastructure. So that's the big upshot. It's, I guess, the bad news part of it. The good news, according to Eric Court, one of the authors of this study from University of Michigan, is that leaks from pipelines and other infrastructure are fixable, right? It's a source of very powerful methane is the main ingredient in natural gas. It's also an incredibly powerful greenhouse gas. That's why it's important to account for it in our emissions budgeting and accounting. And these are fixable ways, kind of low-hanging fruit of reducing some emissions from our Northeast cities and also making our natural gas and energy infrastructure more efficient.
Right. But I imagine that means there's some cost implications here.
Yeah, absolutely. Although, you know, you have to think the cost structures in the markets are not necessarily set up with the right incentives to get this done. That's why we have these leaks. But it's the main ingredient in natural gas. So less of it that leaks out is you know, should affect the bottom line for our both energy consumers and energy producers, because at the moment we're just wasting fuel, just venting it into the atmosphere.
That's right. And that's Dr. Heather Goldstone. She hosts Living Lab Radio. If you want to hear more about this study, plus a number of timely science topics, tune into Living Lab Radio. It's each Monday morning at 9, again at 7, and wherever you get your podcasts. We're out of time. I want to thank Heather Goldstone for joining me this morning, Kristen Young from the Cape Cod Times, George Brennan from the Martha's Vineyard Times, Holly Pretzky of the Vineyard Gazette, Casey Myers from the Provincetown Banner, Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle, and WCAI's Sarah Mises-Tan and Sam Houghton. I want to thank you for listening. Have a great weekend.